papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project gives you a half hour of commentary and analysis on what's going on in the media with some experts from the Capital Region community. We hope we can be fairly described as such. I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union, with my colleagues here. We have Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick and Ian Pickus. So, Judy Patrick, you are no longer the vice president of the New York Press Association.
I am no longer. I left there a week or so ago. I'm trying to find a way to harness the smarts, the passion, the interest of people of my generation, baby boomers perhaps, who have left journalism, but who are still actively involved in the news. And I want to help the local news organizations out there that are struggling. You know, what I have found is a lot of these small local news organizations, the reporters who work there, they don't have the mentors like they used to. And so I'm trying to think of a way to hook up young reporters who need some guidance and with people with experience. So that's my pipe dream at this point.
Speaking of people with experience, Barbara Lombardo next to you, formerly executive editor of the Saratogan and the Record of Troy. But you're reaching out to young people, teaching at UAlbany, of course.
Right, still involved as a journalism adjunct at UAlbany.
But it is interesting, the notion of the newsroom mentorship that Judy is saying is missing. You used to have that in your
totally
newsroom.
I totally agree. And that one of the things that I really enjoy about teaching at UAlbany is bringing back, for me, that experience of working with up-and-coming journalists and helping them understand how to cover a story and how to approach a story and the words to use and how to find sources. So I'm sort of moved what I was doing in the newsroom to a journalism class.
Yeah. And Ian Pickus is the news director of Northeast Public Radio. You hire a lot of young people. Well, when you hire, they tend to be young people.
Right.
I don't mean to say that your hiring is a lot of people, but you take on people without a lot of experience and you have to kind of guide them into it.
It's been eye-opening for me. And I should say, like, my first journalism rabbi was Barb Lombardo, you know,
hey.
And she did that mentorship for people. And there are a lot of them. I know the Saratogian newsroom went through workers and reporters over the years. But I have that in mind now because I'm noticing with a semi-milestone birthday on the horizon that I am of a different generation from the students that we're hiring to be interns and out of college for newsroom jobs now. You know, there's a very common cultural touchstone that people play as a punchline, but it's true. The kids we have who are joining the newsroom now, who are excellent and so smart and they have so much energy, they were born like after 9/11, you know, which was a formative event for people of my generation and how we understood the news and so on. So even though in my mind, I'm just like them, what I'm accepting is that I do have some institutional knowledge and I've been around the block. And when a mayor's office is mad at you, it's for me, it's not the first time, it's the 100th time. And I can kind of put my hand on their shoulder a little bit. And I hope that they are getting the same thing from that kind of back and forth that I got way back when in the Saratogian newsroom, which is now a place that serves pizza and coffee, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, I would hasten to add that the Saratogian does still exist as a daily print product and a 7-day-a-week online product. They don't have a physical location.
And the problem for a lot of
local
newsrooms, there are not as many editors as there used to be. And those editors are so busy just putting out the product, they do not have time to talk about the investigative work, to refine the writing. They can give the stories a once over and then off they go. And the young reporters that I'm talking to are saying, we want more guidance.
You know, I do recall so well as a young reporter coming into the newsroom at Newsday and finding my skills that I had worked at a small newsroom. I had a master's from Columbia. I thought, hey, I'm pretty good at this stuff. And I was amazed at what a difference a really great professional editor made in getting me up to speed. I thought of it right away. The word that I brought to it in those days was they taught me how to point up my story, how to make a story actually have a point and get it across the finish line without just being this amorphous mass of what happened yesterday. And so that kind of guidance, I think you're right, is often missing for people who have to jump right in and they're perhaps the only reporter covering a community. Their boss doesn't have time because there are so far fewer bosses than there used to be.
And they're often working remotely too.
Yeah. No place to actually have that sort of collegial. It's interesting, Ian, you talk about hiring people who were born after 9/11. You, in fact, were born after Watergate. Mm-hmm. And for us...
By a lot.
Yeah.
He hastens to add.
Yes, indeed. But, you know, for some of us, that was such a formative thing of our journalism careers. I think I chose to go into journalism because of what I witnessed in Watergate and how the Washington Post and the New York Times had made such a difference in the life of the nation by their reporting. And I thought, well, I'm going to be one of those people.
I'm with you. I was in college during Watergate, and it inspired me to take that track.
And this is why we are so disillusioned now, because it was almost a golden era of journalism. A lot of editors, a lot of accountability journalism, a lot of people in government who would pay attention to us and recognize the need for us to do our work. And those days are long gone, and the attacks on our profession have just intensified in the last decade or so.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but there are a couple of things that have changed since that era. One is that, you know, at the time, Republicans listened to the news scoops of CBS and the Washington Post and said, hey, this is substantial, and ultimately the president's got to go. And today you could imagine if there was a similar scandal, it would be either dismissed as fabricated or just disbelieved totally. The second thing, and I've read a number of theorists on this, is that Watergate made a generation of reporters who were looking for their own Watergate and sometimes treated every single sort of misstatement by a public official as a cardinal sin. And that was not always the case. And that may have hastened the public distrust in media and also on the part of public officials, less of an appetite to deal with reporters because they always felt that they were trying to get them in some way.
I think that's a very interesting analysis. I even remember a young editor telling a rookie reporter who reported this back to me, taking her outside the newsroom and pointing down the street to City Hall in this small city where they were reporting and saying, you see them? That's the enemy. And I don't think that's true. I really regret that. Don't you?
That is very regrettable. Mm-hmm. I remember, I think it was Ben Bradley at the time, had said something to the effect of bringing down a president was not a time to gloat, that we need to be humble, we're doing our jobs. And I would say that to my staff, too, that you feel like you're going after something, you want to report something, you want to expose wrongdoing and hold officials to account, but you're also not there to bring people down and to find something where maybe there isn't anything.
Yeah, that whole notion of gotcha journalism, that we're going to, you know,
right,
we're going to catch them making too much overtime, we're going to catch them paving their own driveway. Often important stories, but you have to keep in mind why you're doing it, what difference does it make, and why does this matter to your reader? And I think those are things that at least have stuck with us in our profession.
It is interesting that in the context of doing that, of the focus on what is negative, and then in the eagerness of successive administrations in Washington attacking the press as being problematic and attacking government as being problematic. Remember, Ronald Reagan became president saying government isn't the solution, government's the problem. We in the media, joined by people who are opportunistic in politics, contributed to the loss of trust that is now endemic in the country. And it has come back to bite the media ourselves because we are no longer trusted, nor is government, nor are any institutions. And I don't know how that actually gets rebuilt without simply glossing over real offenses that we're seeing now coming out of the White House, for example. But a lot of people don't trust what they hear or read.
Well, the amount of news and the source, or news, quote unquote news, and the sources that you can get them from are so different than they were when we were coming of age. And it makes me think of people before us who were coming of age during the Joe McCarthy era. And I saw Good Night and Good Luck down on Broadway the other day. And just a reminder of how horrible things were and how much courage it took for, do I call it courage, that CBS knew to do the right thing, that Edward R. Murrow would do the right thing and to expose the wrongdoing. And without that, who knows how long it would have taken for Congress to come around on that.
But people believed at that time, to Ian's point, there was a shared sensibility of what is news, of what's real, and that seems to be lacking now.
That's for sure.
And it brings us to the point about CBS 60 Minutes, which is the flagship broadcast journalism news product, losing its editor, who is not leaving in a happy place at all.
Yeah. The top producer, Bill Owens, who's been running the show since 2019, only the third person in the history of 60 Minutes to have that title of executive producer of the program, has resigned, saying he can no longer run the show the way he used to, the way he wants to. I guess it's because of people above him at CBS suggesting he needs to cut his cloth to match the season's fashion, right?
You know, Semaphore, another news agency, is reporting that Sherry Redstone, the head of Paramount, which is the parent company of CBS, had gotten very involved in reviewing 60 Minutes programs, especially wanted to know when Trump stories were involved. And that was something that had accelerated in recent 3 weeks, and Owens was saying he did not feel like he could do his job when he had overlords essentially looking over his shoulder, not necessarily killing stories, but putting enough of a wet blanket on things to make them worried about what they were producing. I mean, 60 Minutes, again, more than a flagship, was one of the leaders in terms of ratings for years and years. 60 Minutes on Sunday night was must watching,
yep.
And it brought in a significant amount of revenue to the network. This is what happens when you have a news organization owned by a multinational, multifaceted company, because the interests of the corporation overshadow the journalistic needs of the news organization.
Trump himself actually is suing CBS and Paramount, as you know, for $20 billion, claiming that in a 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris, they deceptively edited it to supposedly help her get elected. Now, there's no sense, I don't think, that Trump would actually be able to win this in court, right? But because this administration uniquely, we would have to say as journalists, honestly, uniquely is manipulating agencies to try to exert its will, this is problematic because Paramount is trying to pull off a multi-billion dollar sale of the company to Skydance, and that requires approval of the FCC, which is controlled by somebody who is very much a Trump loyalist, who Trump has said, you should prosecute these networks. So you can see why Sherry Redstone would be freaked out, right?
Right. And we know that the administration, as you say, Rex, is pressuring news outlets as we speak. Facts of the case, though, you know, every interview on 60 Minutes gets edited. I mean, that's the whole idea of the show, is that they are doing journalism. Trump didn't sit for a 60 Minutes interview at all. Vice President Harris did. And not only that, he stormed out of his last one with Leslie Stahl the time before that. So, I mean, who's really not playing fair here?
Also, in the fundamental of the law is if you have a suit alleging that you have been disadvantaged, let's say, to $20 billion, you'd have to find that there was an impact of this lawsuit and that you had a loss. And I can't imagine how somebody who won the election would be able to claim that he was disadvantaged.
He's also been unhappy with other 60 Minutes investigations, one or stories, one involving Greenland, in which he's suggested the FCC needs to investigate. So this whole idea of bringing the power of the FCC to bear when it comes to trying to mold news coverage to your liking is very, very dangerous. And I can't imagine what's going to happen. I do want to say that I really appreciated the CBS Evening News anchors who came forward, and at the end of the news broadcast, they thanked Bill Owens. They concisely, without opinion.
They didn't editorialize.
Yeah, they did not editorialize, but they just laid out the facts. This is what happened. This guy was a great producer, and he did not feel he could continue on, and he was also the producer of CBS Evening News. It was very brave of them to say that, because at least asserting that bit of credibility for CBS.
It's a problematic time because this is happening elsewhere. The Los Angeles Times owner has demanded that he see all the editorial page content, the opinion page content that relates to Donald Trump, and has installed this artificial intelligence meter of right to try to give the other side of a story or something like that. A crazy notion, as though truth has a very neatly structured white and black, good and bad, that you can decipher by artificial intelligence or otherwise. Totally missing the notion of nuance in journalism, or the fact that truth is not always found between this guy and this guy.
And it's easy enough for a news director like Ian to withstand the pressure of a mayor calling up to complain about a story. It's harder when the CEO or the owner of the company is pressuring you as well. So this is a whole heightened level of oppression, I would say.
Here's an idea from one of our listeners, Mark in Buffalo, who is a retired public radio journalist, says he's been listening to this program for years and understands the need for news organizations to demand full access to the White House. But he's writing about how we ought to respond as journalists in the face of pressure. And he's suggesting that the notion of some of the media being excluded from briefings and so on, he says, starve the man who seeks attention. Let the Trump press office allow lesser news organizations in rather than the Times or the AP. He'll soon learn that these faux news agencies don't have the reach he's seeking. We won't be missing anything other than misinformation, lies, and distortion. So he's saying, why do we need to even have reporters going to the press briefings? Do we really need to hear the press secretary lie and spin at her briefings? Do we need to hear Trump himself accuse the media of engaging in fake news? So what do you think about this idea of simply not covering some of the stuff? We had this conversation.
Yes,
before.
For 10 years.
10 years that you can remember because you're a young
fella. I'll take it.
It's a tricky issue. But I think last week when we were talking about something similar to this, and I wish that there had been a Spartacus moment in the press briefing room when Caitlin Collins of CNN was shot down trying to ask a question that every American should want to hear the president's answer to. That was awful. And the other reporters who were not representing the far right wackadoodle stations could have, and I think should have, stuck with that question. And even if it totally disrupted the press conference, disruption seems to be the order of the day.
Sometimes you have to take a stand. And actually, in that regard, Ian, I'd like for you to talk about something if you could, because you've had a very interesting moment here at WAMC in which you've had to actually take action with regard to something that has been shut down for your reporters.
Yes, and this is an example of, you know, sort of what you usually don't see that goes into local reporting. Our Berkshire Bureau reporter, our Berkshire Bureau chief, Josh Landes, was covering a special vote in the town of Great Barrington, Massachusetts, the other day. They were going to take up an issue of purchasing a local water district. And when he arrived at the meeting, which is his right as a member of the public, doesn't get any special access because he's a reporter, obviously, was told that he was a non-resident of Great Barrington, and so he had to ask permission from the appointed town moderator in order to enter the meeting. Now, that is just not true. It is not the case. There was a claim that a local bylaw had been put in place years ago, and the bylaw required the town moderator to let people who don't live in Great Barrington in. No, this was an open meeting conducting town business. Any member of the public, for any reason, maybe they just are interested in water districts, can show up to a town meeting. Now, a couple problems that sort of escalated this. Josh stepped out later and heard people at the door on behalf of the town saying the same thing to other people who would have attended the meeting walking in. At the same time, a reporter from one of our fellow local outlets had gotten in no problem. So the rule was being applied haphazardly, but the bigger issue here is that there should not be a rule requiring the moderator of a town meeting to let anybody in for any reason. And we talked it through and ultimately decided to file a formal complaint with the town of Great Barrington, which requires the town to respond in a period of 14 business days. As we speak, they're still within that window, so we haven't gotten an official response. It also requires them to let the state attorney general of Massachusetts know that this complaint has been filed and to explain how they're going to rectify their rules.
Mm. So this is actually putting public officials on notice that you're not going to be rolled over, basically. This is ex post facto. The event happened, but it's important to do these kinds of things to say, you can't do this in the future when we're going to stand up for access to the information. The difficulty is that in a lot of places, a lot of states, public access is being rolled back. Florida used to have some of the most open government access laws in the country, and they've had statutory rollbacks of that under Governor DeSantis. And so you're lucky to have this in Massachusetts, where even, my goodness, the Attorney General gets notified. That isn't a provision in New York state law. That's a pretty cool thing. But the question is, will it make a difference going forward? Or, you know, we always worry about this as reporters. Are people just going to sort of go around behind our backs and make decisions outside the public sphere entirely?
And Josh and I spent a lot of time on the phone trying to figure out how do we deal with this? Because on the one hand, after arguing with multiple town officials, he got in, he got what he needed. We were able to cover the story. But on the other hand, he doesn't want to be the story. The last thing we want is to make the story about this important vote be about a reporter who is facing resistance to walking into a public meeting. But if we don't call it out, we don't know who else they're keeping out, or they're saying perhaps to somebody, you can't take pictures in here, which would also be illegal. So we felt it was important to plant a flag on this one and to force the town to say, we're not going to do this anymore. Because who knows, maybe next time it is a resident of Great Barrington and there's another arbitrary rule because they don't like the cut of their jib.
Hey, and do you have to present ID when you walk in the door? I mean, that seems, how did you even know whether someone lives in your town or not? And that seems like another obstacle to public participation in local government.
And, you know, one other important fact was that, just coincidentally, the town moderator who was supposed to be granting permission on a per case basis was busy moderating the town meeting on the stage at that time. So I don't even know how that would function in practice.
Well, I'm hoping that this serves as an example to towns everywhere, at least in Massachusetts, that this is not going to be tolerated if indeed the outcome is as I hope it will be, as it should be.
The difficult thing when you're a news manager, as Ian is, and as we have been in our newsrooms, is making these decisions to do this, knowing that there will probably be some repercussions.
Yes.
That the local officials will hold it against you for calling them out. And you're always at a disadvantage when public officials say, I don't want to talk to you. On the national scale, Elon Musk, for example, has not sat for an interview with anybody except for Fox News. And here's a guy who's having huge impact on our nation, who doesn't allow himself to really do interactions for any challenging interview for at least more than a year, apparently. So this, he is basically shutting out the media who he perceives might be hostile to his free functioning. And certainly, you could find the same kind of thing happening in Great Barrington. You could find that Josh could be iced out by the officials there.
And let me tell a somewhat related story. You know, Josh is a, I love the guy, hard-charging local reporter. He is a lifelong resident of Berkshire County. He's born and raised in Pittsfield. He loves the place. He is the kind of guy who wants Berkshire County to succeed because it's his home. There was a local official in Berkshire County who iced him out. He put him in the penalty box for a period of a couple years. And this was somebody who was serving in a high-level elected role who was not heard on WAMC for a very long time until they finally were able to sort of bury the hatchet and get him back on the air. And I was glad that happened, but I was also glad that we held our ground because it all stemmed from a story, you know, that we had to cover. He wasn't happy with how he was depicted in it, and he did not talk to Josh for years after that. And that is something we just had to absorb.
You do sometimes, and you're not going to be able to make public officials happy. Nobody likes having their mistakes pointed out, and probably will always feel as though, I think this is just endemic in our relations with public officials, nobody likes to be second-guessed. And second-guessing is a bit of what some reporting is often about. But it's not the same as what we, well, it is the same as what we hear a lot in Washington these days. It's the media's fault. It's what Pete Hegseth says, you know, shame on these people for reporting this story about my leaking military strike details.
Look, Pete, if you're going to text it to us, you're making the job easy.
Right. It distracts from what the actual issue is to blame the media, blaming the messenger.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's even older than Ian.
That reminded me just real quick about a famous Ken Lovett story when, and he wrote about this in the Daily News, when he had been on the phone with the governor's office, they hung up, except they didn't. And then they talked for another hour and Ken Lovett heard it all. before they realized it. And, you know, he wrote a story. You know, that's a bank error in your favor as a reporter.
Yeah. That is permissible. What you overhear, what you get on your signal chat, or what you get on the phone that hasn't been hung up, that's not the same thing as deceiving people, shielding the fact that you're a reporter. That's a little bit more controversial. These are ethical questions that we love having the opportunity to think about them, because oftentimes you just are so much in a rush to try to get what's going on into the day's broadcast or onto your paper that you don't have a lot of time to deal with some of these finer issues. Anyway, we are out of time.
Man, that was super fast.
How about that? That's our media project for this week. Barbara Lombardo was here, Judy Patrick, Ian Pickus, and I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to our producer, Dave Gustina. And we thank you for joining us. Come back again next week for another edition of The Media Project.
Now, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's on ting-a-ling-a-ling city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, WAMC news director Ian Pickus, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
It's wonderful to represent the world. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.